Please turn in your Bibles to Matthew 23, page 829, if you are using a pew Bible, Matthew 23. This morning, we're, Lord willing, going to finish the seven woes that Jesus gives to these Pharisees and scribes. Again, remembering that he's talking in front of the crowds in the temple on the week of the Passover, and he's saying these things in front of the crowds, in front of the disciples, and especially in front of these Pharisees and scribes. Last week, we looked at the first four woes. This week, we want to finish the final three. So let's look at Matthew 23, beginning in verse 25. It says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first, clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside may be clean. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding the blood of the prophets.' Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." For those of you who were not here last week, I began trying to explain that every human on earth, every person in this room, has a difficult, but a critically, eternally critically, job given to them by God. You all have a divinely ordained responsibility to make sure that you are not hoodwinked by spiritual leaders. If you fail to do this job in any way, you will always, to some degree, expose yourself to harm in this life and possibly one to come. Again, God designed you to need leaders as a human, as a Christian. You need shepherds. And that's why in Hebrews 13, he commands you to follow, to imitate, to obey, and to submit to spiritual leaders in your life. Because these commands hang over your head, waiting on you to fulfill them, you need to be equipped with which leaders need to be obeyed and submitted and followed and imitated. You've got to be equipped with how to evaluate spiritual leaders so you know which ones to mark out and avoid and which ones to follow. You need the care of shepherds, but as we said last week, not all shepherds are created equal. There are bad shepherds. In our text, there are even hypocritical shepherds, which appear good but are inwardly evil. And this is where the job becomes too much for some professing believers. Some professing Christians don't like the idea of calling someone a false shepherd or a false teacher. Many have wrongly and harmfully bought into this postmodern lie that Christians must always be nice people. But as Matthew 23 showed us last week and this week, sometimes to be Christ-like, you must say hard words. So I need you to listen carefully. If you are either unable or unwilling to speak hard truths to people, if you are either unable or unwilling to call a spade, then you will never be able to watch out for your own soul, much less the people around you. Again, I want to repeat the warning that I gave last week. If we just took the broadest brush possible and separated Christians very generically into two groups, you would certainly have one group that is what I call too trigger happy, that they want to make a mountain out of every molehill, and if you disagree with them on anything, you are a false teacher going to hell. there is a side of Christianity where if we just broad brush swept everyone into one of two categories, there are people that need to be reminded that not every disagreement needs you to come with it with full and lethal force. It would be helpful to take that group and explain the difference between being bold and being rude. There is necessary context for that. It would be helpful to explain to them not every disagreement should be weighed the same, but that's for another day. What I'm more concerned about is this other group of generically categorized Christians that I think is much, much larger, and it's this group of Christians that run from all things related to conflict. So many people professing to know Christ think it's arrogant and prideful to act like you know anything for sure. If you speak with any level of confidence, they think you're prideful. It certainly is the forbidden territory or the unforgivable sin to actually tell someone they're wrong. Peace, according to them, must be kept at all costs. And so they almost never find hills to die on. Again, this is the group I'm more concerned with because of our passage. In order to grow in spiritual maturity, you have to grow in your discernment on when to kindly disagree with people and when to speak sharp words that are meant to pierce and cut. One example of this kind of a balance with someone's life was first told to me in seminary. It stuck with me through the years. While I was at Master's Seminary, I had several classes with Dr. Nate Busnitz, who helps run the seminary now. But his father, Dr. Irv Busnitz, also taught Hebrew class. Nate, the son, told a story that only makes sense if you know how amazingly kind Dr. Irv was. It still is. Dr. Irv Busnitz served on leadership at Masters from its earliest days. His calm and quiet demeanor was obvious to everyone because he was just such a gentle and loving person to the students. Some people would affectionally, not really to his face because it could come across as rude. He is your professor, but Papa Busnitz, like he's just kind of the campus grandpa. Everyone knows you're going to get an arm around you. You're going to get a good, encouraging talk to. Dr. Busnitz would not hurt a fly, is what many people understand. We loved Dr. Busnitz for being that kind of a kind, gentle person, but he's a man who understands that sometimes sharp words need to be spoken. When souls are at stake, when truth is being attacked, a Christian must speak hard truths in love. And so Nate, his son, told us about this story. Some of you heard it at Shepherd's Conference a few years ago. But he said when he was about 10 years old, him and his dad, Irv, were in the living room. There's a knock on the door. Irv opens it. There's two Jehovah's Witnesses there, a man and a woman. And then there's a small boy, about 10 years old also. Irv spoke briefly, you know, going back and forth with the adults there. And so finally, he gets to the point in the conversation where you can tell this is over. He asked the adults, "May I speak with the child?" They gave him permission, so he knelt down. Papa Busnitz kneeling down, getting eye to eye with this boy, this kind, gentle man of God. He looks at this about 10-year-old and he says, "Son, do you know what the Bible says about the people you're standing with right now?" The boy kind of stood there silently. Nate couldn't remember if he nodded his head yes or no or whatever, but he didn't say a word. Irv continued. He said, "The Bible says that it would be better that a millstone be hung around their necks and that they were drowned in the ocean, then they would lead a little one like you astray." Again, let me tell you, Dr. Busnitz is one of the most loving, kind people that I can think of. But he knew in that moment the most loving, kind thing to do was to speak hard words to these people. He understood and understands that every Christian must be prepared to identify and call out false teachers when the time calls for it. And that's the job I want to remind you of this morning. So if you find yourself needing help in this area, you need to listen to Jesus in Matthew 23. He is going to expose the false hypocritical leaders of Israel's day. But in doing that, he's going to teach you what makes hypocritical leaders so dangerous. With these last three woes that we'll cover, Jesus will show you that a hypocritical leader has first a misleading appearance, and second, they have a misleading admiration. Hypocritical leaders have a misleading appearance and a misleading admiration. And all of this is building on the first four that we saw last week. If you'll recall, Matthew 23 has seven woes. And they are seven individual statements of woe, but it seems best to pair them together and leave that seventh one off for emphasis. So the first two kind of talk about a related thing. The next two talk about a related thing. And as we'll see this morning, our first two talk about a related thing, and then that seventh one is magnified. In the first pair of woes, Jesus said the Pharisees and scribes claimed to help people find and enter the kingdom of God while they were actually securing their spot in hell. They slammed the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces and flung open the gates of hell, letting everyone go in that could. This was their misleading ministry. They also had a misleading standard because they hypocritically covered and cloaked their lying and their disobedience with a veneer of righteousness. So these leaders would lie, but they would do it in technical loophole kind of ways where you would go, oh, okay, I get it, I understand. You didn't say it was by the gold of the temple, you just said it was by this gift over here. And there was a little parsing of words to cover up their knack for lying. They also looked incredibly obedient because they were so careful to weigh and count their little mint leaves. And Jesus says, you guys are neglecting justice, mercy, and faithfulness. So the first four woes show us that hypocritical leaders have a misleading ministry and a misleading standard. Picking up with these next two, let's look at how they also have a misleading appearance. Hypocritical leaders have a misleading appearance. Verse 25, Jesus says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Here is the fifth woe. Jesus setting up a clear contrast between the way things are and the way things appear. Jesus is saying he knows the difference between what he knows is true about them and what people think about them. Jesus says the Pharisees look a certain way, but they are a different way. They are hypocrites. He says, woe to y'all, in my version, because the reason, woe to y'all, is because you clean the outside of the dishes, not the inside. And for years, I have read this passage and thought about cleaning dishes after you eat. You know, that's kind of the natural way we think. I mean, you can imagine if you eat and don't clean the inside very well, not only is it dirty, it quickly becomes nasty. At some point, it's going to become dangerous. And so Jesus is saying, when you're done eating, you clean the outside of things, but you don't clean the inside. And that's nasty, it's bad, the inside's dirty, but the outside looks clean, it's deceitful. That is a true statement, but that's not necessarily what Jesus is drilling into here. Jesus knows that the Pharisees, more than anyone, were consumed with this idea of priestly ritual washing. The Pharisees were laser-focused on proper hand-washing and cup-washing and even sofa washing. They were focused on this because they were trying to always be kept from becoming ceremonially unclean. You've got to learn this because this is so foreign to our world. Hold your spot here. Go to your right, Mark 7. Go to Mark 7, page 842 in your pew Bible. Mark 7. This is where Mark gives us a little bit of a insight to this world of washing with the Pharisees. I'm going to go ahead and tell you now, it has nothing to do with hygiene. Mark 7, verse 1. Now, when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes, so just notice, different context, but same group of people as Matthew 23. The Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem. They saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. So again, this is not about hygiene. It's about ritual cleanliness and defilement. Verse 3. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. So understand, the Jews, by influence of the Pharisees, they took priestly washing rituals and the Pharisees pressed it to cover more areas and more people. They threw this on everyone. And so when they would go to the market, chances are you bumped into someone who was unclean. It could be an unclean Jew or it could be one of those wretched Gentiles. So when you return, you've got to go through this process to make sure you wash your hands Because if you don't, you're going to pick up food and eat it with unclean hands ceremonially, and now you become unclean. This is what they were doing. This is what they think. Look at verse 5. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, Jesus, why do your disciples not walk according to the traditions of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? And he said to them, well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Jesus rebukes these scribes and Pharisees for honoring God with their lips or their hand washing, but not their hearts or their minds. They were consumed with washing the outside of things and neglected the inside of themselves. Drop down to verse 18. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. Verse 20, and he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. So the Pharisees had it completely backwards. All of their focus and attention was on the external ritual purity of things going into their body, and they were ignoring the real source of defilement, their own hearts. Go back to Matthew 23. With that kind of a context in mind, reread what Jesus is saying. When he says you wash the outside of your cups and plates, he's not talking about doing dishes after dinner. He's talking about you go through all these hoops. You take all this effort to make sure your utensils are ritually clean, and yet what's inside is not. It's defiled. Jesus says, woe to you because you're fastidious in making sure the outside of the cup and plate are clean, but you ignore the inside. It's full of greed and self-indulgence. This is a reference to the fact that the Pharisees cared so much about using clean cups and plates, but what was on their plates and what was in their cup was obtained sinfully. The word here for greed is a word that doesn't refer to the desire for things. It actually refers to the thing that was obtained. And now, again, they were greedy. That says that elsewhere. But Jesus says here, you're so worried about the cup being clean, but inside of it is something obtained sinfully. You think about that. Jesus makes it clear on many occasions these men abused people. These Pharisees and scribes had real authority in Israel, and they used it to abuse people under them and benefit themselves materially. Something not too far-fetched from our own day. These people, these Pharisees, preyed on people, not praying, but praying like a predator, because they were greedy and self-indulgent. Another sign of hypocrisy. They convinced people, we've got your best interest in mind, but they don't. They have their own best interests in mind. They convince people, we're here to help you, but you're not. You're here to help yourself and harm us. This is what Jesus exposes. In Luke 16:14, Jesus says the Pharisees were lovers of money. They cared more about fleecing the flock than feeding the flock. And then, pay attention to this, in Luke 20:47, Jesus says they devour widows' houses. How do they do that? How do they devour widows' houses? Well, two verses later, there's a chapter break, and it's so unfortunate, but there's a chapter break. Two verses later, Jesus points to that widow who gives her last two coins. She gave all that she had, and sadly, this lady is usually upheld as a model of giving. That is not the case. That's not the context. That's not the point. I don't know how that understanding started, but it's completely backwards. Jesus says nothing about her faith. He says nothing about being pleased with her giving. He never says one word to the disciples about doing what she did. What he does do is point out the hypocritical false leaders. They love to ransack and devour widows' houses, and she's a prime example. She gave up everything because she bought into their system. Those men don't care that life's already hard enough for a widow. They don't care that she's already having a hard enough time in life. They just want her money. I don't care how much it is, give it to me. This lady's not an example of Christian giving. She's a tragic example of what false shepherds do when they abuse sheep. They'll stop at nothing to abuse and benefit from them. Again, this is the kind of abuse that these shepherds of the Pharisees were doing, and they were gaining money and possessions through these sinful means. And Jesus says, what in the world is the point of your ritually clean cup if you fill it with stolen wine? Who in the world sits down at a meal that you stole and asks for God's blessing? Again, he applies this to them in verse 26. Look what he says. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate that the outside may be clean. Jesus says, first, the inside must be your focus. Not the cups, not the dishes, not their external appearance, but what goes on them and in them, the inside. Now again, I try to point this out as much as I can, but when Jesus critiques people, be careful to hear what he's actually critiquing. Jesus does not critique the care for external things here. The answer to their problem is not forget the outside, only think about the inside. That is not what Jesus says. He's not critiquing them for caring about ritually clean cups. That's not what he says. He's condemning their extreme concern and care about the outside of things while ignoring the inside of themselves. So again, don't miss Jesus's critique. The external things do matter, but they will never matter. They will never count for anything if you neglect and ignore the inside. Jesus says first, not only, but first clean the inside. Then the outside will be clean. So until you clean the inside, the outside is just window dressing on a house that's going to burn down. You might clean the outside of that cup, but inside is poison that's harmful for you and everyone around you. Jesus says here, if you focus on the inside, on the heart, the outside will follow. Again, if you clean the source of your life, the fruit of your life will follow. So many people spend their time attacking the fruit that they don't like in their life. They don't get to the roots that are driving that fruit out of them. Again, these men couldn't see it. They were blind. They were consumed with trying to change the externals and clean the outside while ignoring the whole reason for the external cleanliness. They were ignoring the inside, and Jesus says that must always have priority. And what a clear warning for us. If you aren't careful, this same exact hypocrisy will consume you. Again, I want you to answer me on this. Does God tell his people to assemble together? Yes, go to church, right? That God says that. Does God command his people to sing to one another? You sound unsure. Does God command his people to sing to one another? He does. Does God tell you to encourage people in your life? Yes. Do you think God's honored when you just merely externally do those things? Not at all. Jesus wants your heart, and if he gets your heart, then the external things you're doing are infused with the meaning they were meant to have the whole time. They were never meant to just accomplish things in and of themselves. But without a new heart that loves Christ, all your external conformity accomplishes is a pitiful and blasphemous attempt to bribe God. So again, does the outside matter? Yes, absolutely matters, but only after the inside has been your focus. Like the commands that we've covered before, when Jesus says you've neglected weightier things, Jesus sets up this idea. We've said it for several weeks now. All of God's commands matter. Some are more central and weightier. They aren't all weighed the same. They are all as central as one another, but they all matter. And here's another instance of that. Jesus says the external and internal matter, but the internal is primary and the external secondary. Again, instead of getting this, the Pharisees and the scribes had what I'm calling a misleading appearance. They worked so hard to make sure the outside of the cup and the plates were ritually clean, but ignoring the defilement within themselves that they insert into those utensils. But Jesus isn't done. He gives another reason, another way that they have a misleading ministry. Look at verse 27. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. Again, we're pairing these together because they hit a similar topic, but they don't say the same thing. Jesus' first woe in this pair talks to the Pharisees about their own defilement inside of them. This one deals with the way they defile other people who come into contact with them. You see, Numbers 19:16 says that when you come in contact with a dead body, it makes you ceremonially unclean for 7 days. That is a word given by God, not some extra Pharisee rule. And so if you are declared unclean, you certainly can't assemble with God's people. The punishment would be death for you. You also can't participate in the activities that are going on until you are declared clean again. So imagine, if you will, traveling from all over Israel down to Jerusalem, coming for this Passover, and you don't know where the tombs are in Israel, and you accidentally graze up against one. You walk across one. You don't know it. And they considered bumping into a tomb, walking across a tomb, as a way to contact a dead body, so you're unclean. So there you are. You're far away from home. You traveled all this way to celebrate the Passover, only to enter the city and accidentally bump into a dead body through touching a tomb, and now you're unclean for 7 days. By the time you get declared clean again, it's time to go home. Again, becoming unclean was a chance you couldn't afford to take. So what they would do is, a month before Passover, in the city there, because so many of the tombs were hard to see for people who weren't from there, they would go whitewash them. And it makes them bright and shine out and stick out, so you make sure to avoid them. They colored them white because they wanted people to make sure to avoid them. They would do this a month before. So as Jesus is saying these words, there was a fresh coat, if you will, of whitewash all over these tombs. They knew exactly what he was saying. And Jesus takes that concept and throws it on the Pharisees. Look at verse 28. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You Pharisees, Jesus says, you've been whitewashed like the tombs, but also like the tombs, your outside doesn't match the inside. Outside, you look clean, whitewashed, but inside of you is the stuff that defiles people. Inside of you is death and decay. You're full of, what he says, hypocrisy and lawlessness. The most lawful people in the land, Jesus says, are lawless. This reminds you that internal disobedience and internal negligence is lawlessness. You are not obeying God just because you jumped through the hoop of what he said. God says, go to church, I go to church, I'm honoring him. No. God says, sing, I honor him. No. If the form is not met with internal realities behind it, it is formalism. And because this is the way the Pharisees are inside, people need to learn to avoid them just like the whitewashed tombs. Though these Pharisees appear righteous, coming into contact with them, listening to their teaching, it actually makes you unclean and unfit to appear before God. Again, if you listen to the Pharisees, if you follow these legalistic, hypocritical, wicked, false shepherds, you will be made unfit to assemble with God's people and worship him. And so rather than being clean, like the outside appears, Pharisees are actually unclean on the inside themselves. And rather than helping people become ritually pure, they're actually infecting other people and causing them to be unclean. The Pharisees have a truly misleading appearance. They claim to be one thing and they are another. They claim to do one thing and they do another. Again, each one of you in this room stands in danger of this same kind of hypocrisy corrupting you. And when that hypocrisy does corrupt you, when you find yourself hoop jumping, you are corrupting people around you because you're teaching them that mere externalism pleases God. Again, that's the hypocrisy that damns you and infects those around you. You start, without words, you start telling people things like, look, God doesn't have to have your heart. Just give him an hour and a half a week and we'll call it good, good. That is not what Jesus is saying. Hypocrisy in a Christian, especially a hypocritical leader, it gives the damning impression that formalism means godliness. But again, listen to me, and I'm not saying this just to be silly, but you can put lipstick on a pig and it's still a pig. You can put a sinner in church, you can change a sinner's vocabulary, you can change a sinner's TV shows and books and music, but they're still a sinner. Until the inside change comes, like Jesus says, you must be born again. Until that happens, you haven't achieved the real heart change that you actually need. Real heart change must always be your focus. And Jesus says that when the heart is truly being dealt with, then the outside things you're working on are actually clean and worth it. That must be the order and priority of your pursuits. And all of this gets us to this seventh and final woe given by Jesus. And this one, I need you to focus. This one is huge. This seventh woe is devastating for the leaders, but also the entire nation of Israel. I've told you before that in the Gospels, you have the religious leaders that attack Jesus and oppose him. They speak blasphemous words against him. You have Jesus' real disciples going out preaching, paying the price. And then in the middle, you have these massive, non-committal, but interested people that just kind of bounce around. Jesus does miracles, the crowds are there, everything's great. Some persecution comes and they scatter, and they just are all over the map in between. Not anymore. Jesus lumps the nation in with these leaders. And so you need to see, secondly, this morning, with this last woe, the hypocritical leaders have a misleading admiration. Hypocritical leaders have a misleading admiration. Verse 29, notice, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous." This hypocritical people, hearing this seventh woe, it's from Jesus expressing their external and obvious admiration for the prophets that have come in the past. We call them Old Testament prophets. They were just referring to them as the prophets. Messengers sent by God to his own people and overwhelmingly rejected and persecuted. But not the Pharisees. I mean, no way they would have rejected the prophets. I mean, look at how they build tombs to them and they make these great monuments to them. There's no way the Pharisees would have participated in that. But Jesus says they're hypocrites, so yes, they would. I don't care that they build the monuments. I don't care that they make these magnificent monuments to these dead prophets. Inside, they are the same exact makeup of the people who persecuted and hated them. Look at verse 30. "It doesn't matter what they do or say, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in the shedding of the blood of the prophets.'" So here you have these hypocritical, false leaders of Israel, and they are professing with their mouth that they love the prophets. They're showing with their actions they love the prophets. And in the meantime, verse 30, they condemn their fathers, which they should have. The fathers did reject the prophets, and they did do murderous things. It's undeniable and overwhelming. God's prophets were rejected by his own people. You look at Elijah, you look at Amos, you look at Jeremiah, and so on. Prophet after prophet sent by God to his own disobedient people. His own people who broke the covenant obligations they had with God. And rather than just destroying them right away, he sends them preachers of righteousness. And what do they do? What is the overwhelming summary of Israel's reaction to the prophets? Listen to this, 2 Chronicles 24:19. "Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to the Lord. These testified against them, but they would pay no attention." The people of Israel often rejected God, which meant when his messengers came, they rejected them as well. But now you have the Pharisees saying, "Well, we didn't do that. I would never." I mean, this is the way they're acting. And Jesus says, "You absolutely would. If you only looked at the Pharisees, you'd believe them. If you only listened to the Pharisees, you'd believe them." But Jesus exposes what they're really like. You remember in the Sermon on the Mount how you had the two houses? And just looking at the two houses, everything looked great. But then the storm comes and washes away what the houses were sitting on. And one's exposed as having a faulty foundation or a no foundation in one sense. This is what Jesus is doing here. I know things look great on the outside. I know the Pharisees say and act like they love the prophets. Let me show you what's underneath. Jesus is showing they have a false admiration. Look at verse 31. "Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets." When the Pharisees say, "We would never have done what our fathers did," Jesus takes that confession and says, "You are sons of your father more than you ever know." We may say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree or their chips off the old block. However you want to phrase it, Jesus is saying you are sons of your father, and I mean more than genealogically. It's not just they're your ancestors, but they are your spiritual DNA, what's made up of that. I know you say with your mouth that you love the prophets. I know you look like with your actions that you love them. But given the chance, you too would reject them and kill them. And how do we know this? How could you say this? Well, look at the way they're treating the one the prophets pointed to. Look at the last, final, capital P prophet that comes among them, the hope of all the prophets, the point of all the prophets, and look at how these men are treating him. You cannot reject and persecute him while saying you love them. This is Jesus' point. And so you are from your fathers. You are like your fathers. Therefore, finish the family business. Look at verse 32. Fill up then the measure of your fathers. Jesus speaks here of them filling up something from their fathers, like a cup that's been filling over the years. Jesus says, go ahead and get it to the top. You wicked leaders, go ahead and get it to the brim of what your fathers have done. This is language that you're used to if you're finding it in the Old Testament. The people hearing Jesus would have been well aware of this. In Genesis 15, when God promises Abraham not just the promises of the covenant, but he says, your people are going to be slaves and mistreated in a land that's not their own. It's going to happen for 400 years, but I will judge the people that do this, but not yet. And the reason he doesn't do it yet, and I'm quoting, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. God speaks of pagan nations very often as though their sins are filling up this cup of his wrath. And when that cup reaches the brim, when that cup is full, he's going to dump it on them and make them drink every last drop of it. This is the language Jesus is using. But in the meantime, while that cup is still upright, it's still being filled. And until it's filled all the way, it's not going to be dumped out. So sin by sin and generation by generation, the cup gets more and more full. It's language of God's wrath being stored up more and more and more until the day comes where the floodgates open and he pours this cup of wrath, not just on these people, but down their throats, choking them and overwhelming them with judgment. This is what God's doing. That's the language Jesus is using here. And everyone would have understood it. But this is what would have been so shocking. That language is not for God's people. You mean we, God's people, have been filling up a cup of wrath? You mean we, the Pharisees, the most obviously righteous people in the land, we're going to have a cup to drink? Jesus says, absolutely. Jesus applies it to the Jews, and not just any Jews, but these Pharisees and scribes. And he says, look, go ahead and fill up the cup. Finish what your father started. Fill it up. And verse 33, you better be sure you're going to drink it. Verse 33, you serpents, you brood of vipers, how are you to escape being sentenced to hell? Jesus says, you men are hypocrites, you're vipers. These are deadly little snakes that can look like sticks. So you may innocently be going to grab a stick to put in a fire and grab a viper, and he bites you and kills you. That's what these men are compared to by John the Baptist and now Jesus. That's what they're like. You expect to do that and not get God's wrath? That you rightly condemn your fathers for mistreating and rejecting the prophets, and Jesus comes among you and you do the same to him, and you think you're going to escape judgment for that? Again, remember, Jesus is saying this to the people with the best reputation, the people who were most respected in religious life. One commentator said this, and I'm quoting, Jesus is judging men who regularly attended worship services, were overseas missionaries, made religious vows, they tithed their income, they meticulously tried every hour of every day to observe God's law, and even built magnificent monuments to the heroes of the faith. Surely such people get into the kingdom of heaven. Jesus says, no, they don't. Why? The answer is their crime of hypocrisy. Again, you've got to look through their professed admiration for the prophets. I know they look like they admire them. I know they sound like they admire them. But in reality, Jesus knows the foundation that's underneath this house. And if given the chance, you would kill and reject the prophets just like your fathers did, because that's exactly what you're doing to me. Therefore, verse 34, therefore, because you're just like your fathers, therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town. Jesus says, because you're just like your fathers, I'm going to send you more people, and guess what you're going to do? You're going to do exactly what they did. I'm going to send you more and more. You're going to continue to reject them and persecute them and kill them. So why would I send you these people? Verse 35, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Jesus treats Israel's rejection of the prophets like a tab. Businesses and people will often have tabs at establishments where they can just keep charging and delay payment. And then one day the payday comes. One day the collection has to be gained. And Jesus is saying, look, your fathers did reject the prophets. And guess what? I didn't pour out the full cup on them. I didn't give them exactly what they deserved right when they deserved it. Again, Jesus is saying, your fathers rejected the prophets. They filled up the cup more and more and more, but they didn't reach the top. You're about to make it go up to the top. And when you do, you Pharisees, when you're about to do that, all the judgment of all their rejection will fall on your head. That tab that's been piling up for years, since Abel through Zechariah and even adding to it now with the Pharisees, that tab is getting paid by you. Again, Abel to Zechariah. Abel being the first murder and martyr in the Bible, killed by his brother because he was righteous and his brother wasn't, all the way to Zechariah, the last martyr in the Old Testament. Now, this has given people a few fits through the years because Zechariah here is said to be the son of Berechiah. When you go to the Zechariah that was murdered this way in 2 Chronicles, it actually was the son of Jehoiada. So people go, Matthew messed this up, or Jesus messed this up. Let me give just a few comments on this quickly. Why would Jesus say from Abel to Zechariah? The reason is because if you take our Old Testament, the one that you are holding in your hands or looking at on your phone or whatever, if you take that Old Testament, the content of it is exactly the same as the content Jesus had. When Jesus read his scriptures, he read the same exact content you have in your Old Testament. That is not what was different. What was different was the arrangement of the books, the numbering and arrangement. So we have 1 and 2 Samuel, they had Samuel. We had the minor prophets, they are the 12 prophets, they have the 12. It was one book. We have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they had the Torah. It was one book. So they numbered them differently, they arranged them differently, but the content is exactly the same. The reason that's important is because our Old Testament ends with Malachi, their Old Testament ended with Chronicles. So what we call 2 Chronicles was the end of their book. Well, the end of that book deals with Zechariah getting murdered this way. So Jesus is saying from Abel, Genesis, to Zechariah, the end of the Old Testament, and all in between are coming on your head. Some people think that the reference to Zechariah is a mistake by Jesus or Matthew. They say this because Matthew says son of Berechiah, 2 Chronicles says son of Jehoiada. The answer, I see it as understanding what son of means. There was no Hebrew word for grandson. They didn't have that language. So whether it was your grandpa, great-grandpa, great-great-great-grandpa, it was son of. Just like in Matthew, Jesus is called the son of David, but that wasn't his father. That was his genealogical father. That was his family tie, his connection. So most likely in 2 Chronicles, Jehoiada is probably a grandpa or some distant genealogy connection, and Berechiah here in Matthew is the actual father. The reason this matters is because Jesus is making a point from Abel, from the first, to Zechariah, the last, and all in between, all those murderous rejections and persecutions, all that guilt was never actually paid for by the people who did it. And when you reject Christ, Pharisees, all that's coming on your head. Therefore, Jesus says, Abel to Zechariah, we may say Genesis to Revelation or from beginning to end. You're going to pay for it. But notice verse 36. It's not just the Pharisees. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Jesus says all these things, all this guilt and condemnation, all the tab that's been tallied up through the years of this rejection, it's going to fall on you blind guides, absolutely. But verse 36, it's also going to come on this generation. Remember earlier I told you that the crowds love to play the shallow middle ground. They love to play the non-committal people in the middle who are interested. They like the benefits of Jesus, but then from time to time they'd swing over to the Pharisees and kind of swing back to Jesus, and they never firmly planted on either side. This is where they end up paying for that. You can't play the middle forever. You can't continue to waffle between two positions forever. The crowds tried to, but eventually they were found to be on the side of the people who reject Christ, And because they took the Pharisees' side, because they took the wicked religious leaders' side, they get their judgment. Again, can you imagine the weight and horror of this accumulated wrath of God that's going to land on these people? You remember how for years the earth grew more and more wicked, and so God sent a flood? You have years going by where the Egyptians are sinning against God's people, and then this devastating exodus happens to them. Well, now for years you have Israel rejecting God's people, God's prophets, and in this final cup-filling act of rebellion, Jesus says that's going to be the thing that puts the cup full to the brim, and you're going to drink it, you and all this generation. That's why what came in 70 AD was so devastating. 70 AD saw hundreds of thousands of Jews killed by Rome. The temple was destroyed. The city was destroyed. Their way of life and worship was destroyed. And all of this came on the whole generation because they were being led by these wicked, hypocritical, blind leaders. There were no excuses just because they were blind being led by blind people. They were responsible to not be led by these blind people. Again, this is why you need so much help from Jesus. You need Jesus to help you know right from wrong and left from right so that you know who's actually speaking on his behalf as his under-shepherd, and you know the difference between them and an imposter. You have a responsibility from God to both watch out for false shepherds and look for true shepherds. Again, you must run from those that harm sheep to those who help sheep. Any mistakes or any negligence in this area of your life, it will only harm you in this one and possibly the next one, and it will harm those around you. This is why sometimes the most loving thing you can do is say hard words to people. When the situation calls for it, the truth must be spoken. In love, absolutely, but the truth must be spoken. This is why sometimes it is very loving to tell people, get out of that church. Stop reading that author. Quit listening to that band. Again, when you see a Christian enter a harmful assembly, when you see a Christian reading a harmful book or watching a harmful Christian show or listening to a harmful Christian preacher or a harmful Christian band, when you see people professing to be sheep, setting themselves up to be slaughtered, love for Christ and love for them must compel you to speak up. That's one of the lessons from Matthew 23. You have to be willing to say hard things when truth and souls are at stake. But Matthew 23 also helps you see why playing the middle ground is never a safe place to be. If you know Christ is Lord, jump both feet in right now and put your roots as deep as possible. Again, you can't continue to waffle between two positions because there is no promise for where you'll end up. Don't gamble with Christ the way the non-committed crowds did and ended up on the wrong side of this war between the Pharisees and Jesus. So come to Christ today. And Matthew 23 lets us know when you do come to Christ today, when you do come to Christ, come to him from the inside with your heart first. Again, learn from this passage how dangerous hypocrisy is for you. It is eternally dangerous and always spiritually risky to merely externally come to Christ. It's harmful for you to believe something to be true about yourself that's not true. And it is harmful for you to try to convince others of something being true of you that's not true of you. Again, this is why you must come to Christ from the heart first. Once you come to Christ, you've abandon your hope for righteousness in yourself. You've found it only in Christ. You then must find a local church to give yourself to. Get yourself surrounded by godly sheep and under godly shepherds so that they can help give you a right assessment of your life. You are not fair to yourself. You will always give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Your flesh loves to think more highly of yourself than you should. So you need help from God's people around you and over you to care for you. Let the people of God help you in a sober assessment of where you are in life. Again, you are only facing danger when you live your Christian life in your own wisdom, trying to follow Jesus without the care of godly people around you and godly shepherds over you. So come to Christ individually. Absolutely. No one comes in a group to Christ. But when you do, as soon as possible, connect yourself with a community of real Christians who care not just about discipleship, but your discipleship. A group of Christians and pastors that will help you love Christ from the inside out. A group of Christians and leaders that aren't hypocritical. Ones that point you not away from Christ, but to Christ, who is our true shepherd. Jesus is the true shepherd. Working back through the seven woes here, comparing their negligence to Christ's obedience to God. Jesus is the true shepherd who did not shut the door of the kingdom in our faces. Instead, he flung it open and made a way for us to enter. Jesus is the true shepherd who by faith makes us as much a child of heaven as he is. Jesus is the true shepherd who only speaks truth. And so when he talks about you, when he talks about your sin, when he talks about anything, he's only speaking the truth. He's the true shepherd who always perfectly kept all of God's laws as our substitute. Jesus is the true shepherd who is pure internally and externally, never hypocritically. He's our true shepherd who never contaminates anyone, but he only and always purifies those who come into contact with him by faith alone. Jesus is the true shepherd who is the point of all the prophets before him. He didn't fight against them. He didn't go against them. He fulfilled their words. Jesus is the one of whom they spoke. This is the one that leads us, and this is the one that leads all who come to him by faith. So Matthew 23 shows us run from false shepherds that point you away from Christ, run from false shepherds that point you to righteousness in yourself, and run from the fickle crowds that surround you, and run to Christ. Run to Christ and rest in him, knowing that as your perfect shepherd, he will do everything it takes to not only bring you to God, like Pastor Dave was saying earlier, but keep you there for all of eternity. So we come to Christ and we rest in him alone. Let's pray.